All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. This is Chapter 4, Supplemental Episode 8. Ryan McIntyre, along with five of his fellow Stanford classmates, was one of the Excite Six, who founded the Excite search engine in the early 1990s. In this episode, Ryan recounts for us what it was like to found a college startup, long before that was a thing that people did, and he explains how the technology for Excite was developed along with the help and guidance of VCs and other early investors. We delve into the Coke versus Pepsi competition that Excite had with Yahoo at the time. We get into the madness of the dot-com era, and we analyze the dominance of Google in the search space today. One quick programming note here. With the holidays coming up, I'll be taking the next 2 weeks off. You might have noticed the poor sound quality for the Danny Sullivan episode that I recorded when I was out of town for Thanksgiving, and it would probably be better if I didn't repeat that. So I'll be back with a new episode on January 5th, and yes, at long last, it'll be a brand new, fully researched chapter episode. I actually have a couple in the pipeline. One will be a history of the internet pornography industry, and also the long gestating chapter that I've been working on about the birth of Amazon.com. So let me take this time to thank all of you for your amazing support of this project. The podcast is not even a year old yet, and yet we have cracked the top 10 of iTunes, seen our download numbers go deep into the six figures, have been featured everywhere from Time to The Verge to Recode and NPR. It's been amazing. It's amazing to me that tens of thousands of you regularly listen to and contribute to this show. So I wanted to take the time to thank you for listening and to encourage you to tell your friends about this podcast in the new year. In 2015, we'll be finally covering the dot-com era in earnest. We'll investigate the history of venture capital. We'll be doing some deep dives into the hows and whys of the bubble economy of the late 90s. So we'll basically be doing economic history, social history, and of course, more business and technology history. So thank you all for listening. Have a healthy and prosperous new year. And right now, please enjoy this exceptional interview with Excite co-founder Ryan McIntyre. Ryan McIntyre, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
My pleasure.
So Ryan, I want to get to Stanford, but I wasn't able to find much on your background at all. Where did you grow up?
So I don't have a short answer for that because I was a military kid. My dad was in the Air Force, and I was born in Germany, but have no real memory of that because it was my first two years, and then we spent a good deal of time in the Washington D.C. Area in the Virginia suburbs while my dad was at the Pentagon. That was sort of through my elementary school years. Then I spent my high school years in Colorado Springs when my dad was stationed at NORAD. And then I graduated high school in 89, and that's when I got out to the West Coast.
And you got your degree in symbolic systems. So were you a math guy or a computer guy? What was the story?
So mainly a computer guy. So symbolic systems is peculiar to Stanford, cognitive science or maybe artificial intelligence at other universities. And it had a sort of variety. It was a multidisciplinary major. It had a kind of variety of subdisciplines. So you took classes in the computer science department, in the math and philosophy department, in the psychology department. But within symbolic systems, you could focus on different concentrations, anything ranging from linguistics to philosophy to artificial intelligence. And AI was my focus within symbolic systems, but it was a relatively technical major, I sort of filled out my schedule with as many other computer science classes as I could.
Yeah, it's funny. There's a lot of people that I talk to. It seems like there was almost like a bubble in terms of artificial intelligence in the late 80s, early 90s. That's what a lot of people ended up studying.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. AI has been one of those things that's been sort of 5 or 10 years away from revolutionizing the world for the last 30, 40 years. But it, obviously recently, there's been some pretty fascinating advances made, at Google and other places with, the sort of deep learning models, which is exciting to see, right? Where it's, finally making progress after, having felt pretty stagnant for a while.
Mm-hmm. So to pick up our story here, you meet some people. Is it in the freshman dorm? Is that where you meet some of the Excite Six?
Yeah, so there was six founders, and we were all in the same freshman dorm together. It was Joe Krause, Ben Lutch, myself, Martin Reinfried, Graham Spencer, and Mark Van Haren. Mark was actually our TA, so he was a junior at the time, but the rest of us were freshmen.
Were you all roommates or just on the same floor?
Just let's see. We were all on the same floor, save for I think Mark was on the top floor. We weren't roommates, any of us, freshman year. I was Martin's roommate the final 3 years at Stanford, and Joe and Graham were roommates for a couple years. And so we all sort of became very close friends first, and that was our how we kind of wound up together. And three of us were symbolic systems grads or majors rather. Ben was EE, and Graham was computer science, and Joe was the lone humanities guy there, political science undergrad, although he had taken a number of technical classes too. He had been considering symbolic systems as well. I should mention around the symbolic systems things too. This is a little bit of an aside, but there also around then there was a pretty interesting set of people sort of in symbolic systems throughout the 90s. Some very well known grads, most notably probably Reid Hoffman and Marissa Meyer, are symbolic systems holders of degree holders from Stanford, as is Srinija Srinivasan, who was employee one at Yahoo. So just an interesting interesting factoid about that major. Sort of had a number of sort of higher than expected set of people who wound up doing pretty interesting things in the in the tech business after they left.
So actually clarify that then a bit for me. So this is a multidisciplinary degree. That what is the main focus then of symbolic systems?
It's kind of an interesting intersection of, I'll call it, language and information. And again, you could look at it as sort of computation. You could look at it as sort of being linguistics focused, computer science focused, kind of depending on where you wanted to take it. Probably my best proxy for it is there's a very famous book called Go to Lesher Bach by Douglas Hofstetter. And if I were to try to describe to somebody the what the symbolic systems major was all about, it was that book.
So is it a little bit semiotics and that sort of thing as well?
Yeah. There's definitely that. I mean, there's mind body philosophy. There's epistemology. There's linguistics, and kind of all mixed up together, but also looking at it from a sort of computational and mathematical perspective as well.
Okay, so then let's get back to the dorm. What was it? Was there one thing that, like, one interest, shared interest? I don't know. Ultimate frisbee or something that tied you all six of you guys together?
Part of it was, I think, a shared interest in computer science and technology, and certainly also in the intersection of that with language. And so that's, that actually is kind of what led us to deciding to build a search engine in the first place. Is it was a, we kind of backed into it in the, what could we work on that's, kind of intellectually interesting to us, and that's how we came to the idea of building a search engine, which was its fascinating intersection of the disciplines of computer science and language, information, etc.
So what comes first, actually, the idea that we want to do a business together, or we want to do some project that is a search engine together?
The first idea actually was let's do a business together. It would be more interesting than going out and getting a real job or working for someone else effectively. And is there something interesting we could work on? And we actually. So we had a couple meals early on at Rosita's Taqueria in Redwood City, where we would often go and just started brainstorming different ideas and kind of wound up, again, I'm sure we had, dozens of other ones, but that's kind of the one we settled on. And this was, mind you, pre-web, really, because this is early 93, probably, where we're, maybe even 92, where we're having some of these conversations, so...
Right, that's
theoretical.
That's kind of standard, practice these days. A bunch of college kids get together and let's do a startup. But 92, 93, you guys are kind of ahead of the curve there.
Yeah, I guess it was not. Kind of wasn't in the air, the whole startup fever, even at Stanford, and in the way it is now, obviously, but. We had attended some or seen some lectures from Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. This researcher there named Jan Pedersen, who was into information retrieval science and whatnot. He had presented this whole thing on vector-based searching and clustering related documents that were together, and how to explore a corpus of documents and whatnot. And we found that really interesting and said, hey, I wonder if we could use some of those ideas and techniques. To build a search engine. It really was sort of a very naive viewpoint at the time, in that let's work on something that's interesting. We looked at the notion of, hey, the structured data, i.e. what a relational database, a SQL database can handle, that feels like it's been quote unquote solved. But the idea that there was going to be this growing presence within companies and elsewhere of digital documents, unstructured, language documents, made us think, there's something interesting to do there. And so, when we first got started, I think we really imagined that we were going to be more of an enterprise software company, right? We kind of backed into becoming a web search engine because we needed, we needed to test our search engine at progressively larger scales with larger sets of documents. And if you think back to 92, 93, there wasn't a lot of places to get big corpus of digital documents. And one of the first things we tested on as we were trying to see how much it would scale was a CD-ROM of a Medline database, which was like abstract for medical papers. And just to give you an idea of it was relatively difficult to go find, giant collections of digital natural language documents. And the next thing we did was say, where could we go get a lot of, a lot of text documents? And there was this, this World Wide Web thing. And we thought, that seems to have a lot. And believe it or not, we had a discussion at the time of, should we write something to go spider the web or to go spider the Gopher protocol? Mm-hmm. So if you remember way back when, right, that was kind of another early protocol around being able to share documents and information. And, we chose the web protocol.
Well, so again, just to interrupt, just to be clear, because you called it a search engine, and so, people would think now that term means, obviously web search engines. But to clarify, what you're saying is that you guys were intrigued with this idea of relational database, basically search technology in general, and the web just presented itself as a way for you to test and prove the technology that you were interested in.
Exactly. So it just happened to be sort of a resource that was, a good and relatively easy place to go get, because it was growing quickly at the time, even then, right? But, still very, very small, relative to where it is today. But it was a place where we could go get lots of documents for free, right, to test and scale the technology. But, at the time, search engines were really sort of, part of this backwater of computer science that had been around for ages, called information retrieval. And that's, what we were really doing is building an information retrieval system. And in fact, some of the first revenue we had as a company before we had even necessarily decided upon being a web search engine was doing kind of behind the firewall type stuff for companies like IDG who wanted to, and again, this sort of puts the era in context, they wanted to have their sort of magazine archives from InfoWorld and some of these other magazines accessible to their modem subscribers, right? So they wanted to make a service where people could dial up directly and search the archive of past issues and whatnot. And so, it didn't even have a web interface, right? It was something that you'd access a la, American Online or CompuServe. And so in that case, the software wasn't necessarily being used to search the web. It was being used to search a kind of a walled garden of proprietary data. And that's kind of where we thought, at least initially, some of our revenue was going to come from.
Well, right. Let's back up for just a second. So you guys, you decide we're going to do a business. So what's the initial organization, raising of money, and prototyping? What does that look like?
So, there's the six of us, and we were kind of moonlighting. Most of us, I think four of us graduated in 93, and then I think Graham and Martin stayed around another year. Graham finished up his master's degree, and Martin, I think, was doing a double major or something. And so, during that time period of sort of post-graduation in 93 to, probably until kind of summer of 94, we were all sort of working in various capacities, more part-time than full-time. I actually spent a year working at Oracle between sort of June of 93 and May of 94. I had student loan bills to pay. I needed an income, so I would, put in my minimum, call it, 35 to 40 hours a week at Oracle, and then go work on Excite stuff in the off hours, where we had set up an office in Joe and Graham and Ben's Palo Alto garage. And so, during that 1 year period, we were all sort of working on just really kind of prototyping software. We each raised $5,000 or $6,000 from our parents. So I think we capitalized the company with about $30,000. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And really that was it. And then we kind of bootstrapped for a while. We had a couple sort of enterprise software prototype development deals with with IDG
and Bob Cringely introduced
yeah.
those.
Yeah. So we got we got hooked up with Bob because of Joe, actually, who was reading his book Accidental Empires and has sort of a how-to manual for doing a startup, because you know we were literally as green as you could be, right? Some of us were still in school, some of us were in our first jobs, didn't really know how to go about it. Ben Lutch said, his favorite phrase was we were unencumbered by reality, right? Like we didn't know what we didn't know. We didn't know that we should be, apprehensive or scared. And we just said, hey, this will be cool. We can do this and see if anything comes of it. And so Joe was reading Accidental Empires. And I think at the back, he basically, Bob Cringely in his, in the notes in the end said, if you have a startup or questions about, how the business works here in Silicon Valley, give me a call. And so Joe got in touch with him, and he was very helpful to us early on, and made those introductions to IDG.
And so on the basis of this project with IDG in a couple of places, this is how you start to gain the notice of VCs like Jeff Yang and Vinod Khosla.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, interestingly, it was, the connection there was, I think it was one of, it might have been Pat, the founder of IDG, was on the advisory board, or one of IDG's board members was also a partner at Charles River Ventures, but in the Boston office, and I think that might have been before they had a West Coast presence anyway. But and so he met with Joe or Graham, and it was intrigued because they had heard, he had heard about what we were doing through the IDG thing, but kind of didn't know what to do with 6 21-year-olds on the opposite side of the country. And so he either connected us to Vinod or to Jeff Yang. I forget who it was. It's kind of lost in my memory, but that's I think how we initially got connected into the VC network over in the West Coast, and wound up having Vinod and Jeff Yang lead our seed round, which was sort of a $500,000 convertible note, and then after 6 months it became a $3 million Series A.
Well, and also around this time though, isn't there like late '94? Isn't there like a $3 million buyout offer from the enterprise software company Verity, right?
Yes, and that's I had neglected to mention that. So, yeah, this is kind of late '94. I think we closed our Series A round from IVP and Kleiner in January of '95. So it's late '94. And Verity offers to buy us for $3 million. And again, this is all the money we've raised at this point is the $30,000 from our families, right?
And you've only been doing this for like a year or so.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I think that year between like 90, 94, I made, $6,000 or $8,000, which doesn't go very far in the Bay Area, even back in, even back in the early '90s. But yeah, we, basically were subsisting on, black beans and rice and burritos.
So was that a hard thing at that point then to turn down $3 million for a year's worth of work?
Yes, it was. I mean, it was, we at the time, we the six of us owned 100% of the company. We didn't really have, our parents more or less just gave us, the money to, I don't think they were expecting, ownership in the company. And we had a very long discussion that night because it was, we had one night where we had gotten the offer from Verity and it was $3 million and it was in Verity stock and it was pre-IPO stock. Verity did wind up going public in 95 as they had planned. And we had to decide between taking the buyout offer from Verity or taking, what was going to be a $3 million investment from Vinod Khosla and Jeff Yang. And we were, you know, we ran kind of everything by consensus at the time. And so we were pretty split down the middle at the time. It was sort of, you know, three of us were like, wow, you know, $500,000, right? That seemed like all the money in the world, particularly to, you know, a bunch of 21-year-olds who had been at it for a year and, you know, had been living on rice and beans. But ultimately sort of through the course of the evening, like we'd pulled up two couches and we're, you know, sitting across from each other, just discussing the pros and cons of everything. And, you know, ultimately, you know, we decided what, you know, it'd be far more interesting to continue forward and keep trying to build something. And
which side did you fall on?
So you know, I'm sad to say that I was on the at least initially on the let's take the buyout offer side of things. You know, which is funny looking back now. You know, given you know it was so clear that the right choice. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, was to keep building and keep going and, you know, double down. Right. And again, you know, we did everything by consensus. So, you know, even though we kind of started out, you know, split down the middle, you know, after hashing it through for, you know, a couple hours, we all came around to, yeah, let's do this. Right. We're young, therefore we're risk tolerant. We don't have families to support. You know, when else are we going to have an opportunity like this? And, you know, to work with, you know, folks like Vinod and Jeff. And, you know, Vinod made a very, you know, impassioned sales pitch to us. Really, we went over to his house in Portola Valley, you know, which is a sort of pretty impressive place. And, you know, we sat with him and, you know, he said, look, this is, you know, you want to take the risk here, right? Like this is an amazing opportunity. I'll work tirelessly to, you know, help make the company a success and, you know, create an outcome that's, you know, way bigger than you could ever have by, you know, selling out to Verity now. And, you know, that was a very convincing conversation to have as well.
I had read that he gave you guys three ideas in terms of where the company could go, like continue with like the enterprise software idea, do online classifieds, or do a search engine. Is that
yep.
Right? How did the search engine win?
Well, I mean, it was interesting because, you know, we actually pursued, you know, the idea was to spend the 6 months on that first bit of the seed funding, convertible note we had from them, you know, really kind of digging in and trying to figure out which one we were going to choose. And we didn't really get very far on the classified thing. We did sort of pursue the enterprise software piece, and we had developed software called Excite for web servers that early on got installed on a ton of different sites that basically let, you know, your users do local searching of the content on the site you were hosting. And then also the web piece. And it was really, we had projects going on with both of those, but the web piece won out both because I think the idea of it was ultimately more interesting to us, and you know we started getting to the point, you know, we launched Excite in October of 95 at Internet World, which was in Boston, excite.com that is, and you know, it was already sort of very promising in terms of being able to sell, you know, real to be able to sell ads and have, you know, really interesting revenue opportunities there. And so that's, you know, it kind of organically, you know, worked out that there was just, you know, we were sure Excite for web servers was installed on, you know, a lot of sites, but that was going to be to go try to, you know, upsell to charge for support and maintenance and upgrades, and, you know, much more of a classic enterprise model, whereas the, you know, sort of the ad-based model just became, you know, really, really compelling. And, you know, we had, and the growth of Excite.com, even from the earliest days, was really fast. And, you know, we had, you know, media folks from sort of the TV and print world coming in to help, you know, sell ads and, you know, big sponsorships. And all of a sudden we were selling, you know, six and seven figure, you know, revenue deals. And, you know, it became pretty clear that was the area with the most potential.
So it was that web search presented the most obvious revenue model, basically.
Yeah, even though, you know, the idea of, again, charging, you know, charging to show ads on, you know, on a website, obviously, was a, you know, was a pretty new idea at the time and was experimental. And in some ways, it would have been more conservative to go with an enterprise software model. It was certainly more, you know, we had, you know, very, very shortly millions of users, and the idea of being able to, you know, sell sort of impression-based ads. I mean, we really were just kind of appropriating the, you know, the print ad and TV ad model of selling audience, and that just took off a lot faster. And again, that's kind of what led to going down that path.
Well, I'm very curious about this because so when you enter, when you launch Excite.com on the web, and so you're entering essentially the search engine space, like what is the space at this point? I'm you know, this is right around the time that Netscape is doing its IPO.
Yep.
So but Yahoo's already been around for a little bit, and so like what sort of space does Excite enter?
Yeah, so you know, at the time, yeah, Yahoo was around, but Yahoo was much more you know, a directory at the time, right? A hierarchical directory,
right,
as
right.
opposed to a search engine. There was InfoSeek, which had sort of launched around the same time we did, which was very similar. And then there was Lycos, right? And those, you know, those were kind of the sort of early, you know, those four companies were the early ones doing something around either, you know, web directory or web search. So, you know, that's kind of the market context, right? It's October 95. Yes, the Netscape IPO, I forget the exact date of that, but it's happening right around then. And, you know, it just was kind of off to the races after that. We wound up going public in April of 96. And again, it was either the week before or the week after, either InfoSeek or Yahoo went public as well. Like, you know, it's kind of like a cluster of these search engine IPOs.
Right, all in the same month, yeah.
Yeah, and to put those in context, I think we raised $30 million, you know, at a, I don't know, $250, $300 million valuation, right? So this is, Robertson Stevens was our lead bank, right? So this is a, you know, almost kind of this pre-bubble era, or, you know, this, you know, the IPOs that are happening now, right, are, you know, usually much bigger, right? You're talking, you know, $500 million, $1 billion, $10 billion market caps, right? And you know, this was a sort of more of a, you know, old school IPO model in the valley. Even though we were IPOing with, you know, with no profits, we did have
right. I was
going to
say,
revenues.
You know, today companies do tend to IPO after they're a little more mature, and you guys are in this post Netscape era when, you know, you're barely a couple years old, and you couldn't have had more than a couple million dollars of revenue at that point, right?
Yeah, well, sort of in terms of historical revenue, yeah, you know, we didn't, you know, we had a handful of million dollars of revenue. You know, we did have, you know, quite a large you know, revenue ramp at the, you know, at the time, right? We I think in, you know, 96, I think we did, you know, close to $15 million in revenue, and then, you know, close to 50 in 97 and 98, 150, right? I mean, it was a, you know, there was real revenue there, which I would contrast between, you know, we were on the very front end of those internet IPOs, right? You know, they got kind of progressively, you know, less metrics driven and more pie in the sky, you know, as we got towards, you know, later in the 90s, right, where companies were going public with even, you know, sort of even less revenue and even less sort of performance after the fact. But, you know, we in fourth quarter of 98, we actually had a, you know, cash flow positive, profitable quarter. That was sort of shortly before we merged with At Home. But, but yeah, I mean, it was, again, it was certainly a frenzied time.
Well, and also, I mean, you're at the beginning of the IPOs, because again, it's sort of like, well, what's the first sort of thing that can be a business model on the web? And it's like, well, help people find things on the web. So
yep.
Was there a sense like you guys are also at the very cusp of this is the Wild West, it's a land grab, let's we don't know where this is going to go. Let's just see where this is going to go, and we need to get all of the ammo that we could possibly acquire to figure out where we need to go, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was absolutely a land grab mentality, and it was also kind of almost like you're forced into doing it because your competitors were doing it as well, right? And if Yahoo and Lycos and InfoSeek are going to go public, like, we better go public too. Otherwise, we're not going to have the resources to compete, right? So, that was certainly again, the notion that a company that was as young as ours was could go public, obviously, was a change in the history of the public markets for better or for worse.
And back to the market that you're in, because I'm old enough to sort of remember, and I mean this with all respect, but there was always a sense that maybe Excite was sort of like the Pepsi to Yahoo's Coke. Like, what was your thinking in terms of, like, were you trying to prove that algorithmic search could be superior? Like, ultimately, we can see that a human directory could not possibly scale with the web. So how are you trying to position in this sort of scrum of four or five major search engines and stuff?
Yeah, the Pepsi to Coke analogy is one I use all the time, actually, and so it's pretty apt, right? Yahoo was always a couple steps ahead of us.
Do you have a thought as to why? Were they just first? Did they do better at branding, or?
They were first. That was obviously, as we know, that advantage is hard to catch up on. I think that we also we very much believed at the time that algorithmic search was the path, and we were technologists first who were sort of slowly coming aware of the fact that in fact we were a media company, and I think Yahoo figured that out before we did to some degree, and so they were always the one we were charging to catch up with, but certainly InfoSeek and Lycos were in our cohort as well shortly after we launched, or just before, I can't remember the timing exactly. AltaVista had launched as well, which I remember was sort of a scary moment for us, because when we launched Excite.com, our index was 1.5 million pages, which seems kind of laughable now, because who knows what the size of Google's index is. I think they stopped posting it, but it's certainly probably 15 billion pages or more at this point. So, we're talking so many orders of magnitude of growth since then. But, and AltaVista, was definitely a more comprehensive search engine. I think they launched with, 15 million or maybe even 50 million pages after we had, shortly after we had this, sort of 1.5 million page index. We believed our sort of relevancy and our search technology was much better. In search, there's, these notions of, and they're usually sort of opposed to each other, but, you can aim for precision or recall, right, which is every last document that contains, the words you're searching for versus, a nicely ranked, hyper-focused list of, the ones that actually, are exactly what you were searching for, right? And so we believed we were better with precision, and AltaVista was definitely going for recall. But there was, again, all of these companies early on were, and obviously in the benefit of hindsight and looking at just the sort of juggernaut that Google became, right? I mean, it's that original assumption around being able to find information on the web, and that that we pursued was turned out to be sort of one of the longest, one of the most important pillars to this day of the web.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, let's talk about that for a second. So, you know, initially there's sort of an arms race amongst the big four or five of who's got the biggest index and who's got the better results and things like that. But at some point, it does evolve into this thing that, you know, they call the portal race, where yep. where essentially, you know, Excite adds email. My wife is excited every time I talk to Excite people because that was her first email address, you know, and, uh-huh. And yep. calendars and horoscopes and all these things. What caused that strategy to take over? Was it just the search for more inventory to sell ads against, or was it we can be sort of like the internet for people? We can be like AOL, but on the web as opposed to dialing in. Everything you need, we're your one-stop shop for the internet.
Yeah, and it was really, you know, that was a big part of the vision was, you know, we can, again, I mean, the portal, you know, is the portal concept is well named, right? This is where you're going to start, you know, every day on the internet. People are searching for things, and gee, isn't search great, but it has aggregated a large audience for us, but shouldn't we be trying to make them stick around, right? Like that was the notion at the time, right? Which was, okay, we want to have longer session lengths, right? We want to have people have a reason to come back every day or, you know, multiple times a day. And the funny thing about search is the better you are at it, the sooner they leave your site, right? And so of course, you know, Google proved actually that by being really, really good at that, and you know, they started out obviously being just search at a time, which was very sort of contrarian thinking at the time because all of the search engines had become portals, but we really did it just to sort of grow our audience and keep them there once they came. And right, and the best ways to do that were things like, you know, putting in your stock portfolio, tracking your news, you know, to having your email there, right? And the idea was absolutely, you know, probably the best proxy at the time was AOL, right? Which is let's just amass a giant audience of tens of millions of users, and you know, and that'll just increase our ad inventory and our value, you know, as we do that. And so that's kind of what led to sort of adding all of these additional features and the belief that was, you know, that was how you would get to know your user base, right? By allowing them to put in their birth date and the topics they were interested in and whatnot, right? You'd get a lot more data about where these users were from. They wouldn't just be kind of anonymous users. We didn't know anything about our users when it was just search.
The analytics and the tracking wasn't as evolved as it is today.
Yeah, no, nowhere close.
Right. So on a personal level, all of a sudden the six of you now we're talking 96, 97 into 98. Now this is a huge company and you're at the forefront of, you know, this economic revolution and this new era of business and things like that. Just on a personal level, what was that ride like for you personally and for all six of you?
Well, I mean, it was an incredible time. I mean, it was, you know, first of all, we were, you know, just working around the clock, right? So there was an element of it that was, you know, that was exhausting. I, you know, broke up with a longtime girlfriend who I, you know, was briefly engaged to, and a lot of that was, you know, part of the reason was because I've been working so much and so intensely. But it was, you know, there was an element of the surreal to it, right? I mean, it was fantastically exciting. It was also, you know, how did we find ourselves in this position where all, you know, where all of a sudden we're, you know, founders of a company that's going public and is, you know, growing to a multi-billion dollar market cap. And, you know, the company grew to thousands of people. And, you know, that was, it was just sort of exhilarating, you know, and at times terrifying and intense, right? But, you know, certainly not an experience that I would, you know, trade for anything, right? It was just to be part of, you know, the dawn of this effectively, you know, new media paradigm was amazing.
And what did your role in the company evolve into? What were the projects that you were working on?
Yeah, so I was, you know, I'd always been a software engineer, techie focused, right? When we started the company, you know, it was clear that, you know, Joe was our one business guy, right? And he evolved to be, you know, senior executive, state board member, you know, was CEO until we brought on George Bell. Graham was our CTO. Graham Spencer's, you know, one of those just singularly talented, you know, intellects and software engineers, right? There's this notion in the world of software and engineering, right, of a wizard principle, where there's, you know, these guys who are, you know, 10x, 50x, 100x more productive than you know, sort of the average or even the really good engineer. And Graham's one of those people, and he was our, and we recognized this early on, right? He was our CTO and really kind of defined the technology vision. So I'd worked, in the early days on the search engine itself, and then on our Excite for Web Servers product. And then as part, worked on, we bought a company early on, timing wise, maybe 97, called Throw, which was sort of an early shot at being a communities platform, or sort of a almost like e-groups and, you know, mm-hmm. Maybe shades of, you know, early Facebook even, helped sort of integrate that team into the Excite infrastructure. I worked on our internal tools group a lot. So like the platform that, and cause we did have a directory team at the time too, who was, you know, manually categorizing stuff and whatnot, a la Yahoo, worked on some of the tools for that, worked on, some of our Excite shopping commerce platform tools, briefly worked on some of the email stuff. So, you know, really kind of just, you know, a whole variety of different projects as we expanded beyond, you know, simply being a search engine into being a portal.
Yeah, that's sort of a crazy education into all sorts of things there.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, because at the time in particular, there was no, you know, off-the-shelf internet infrastructure software. There wasn't a, you know, host of open source projects to, you know, solve a lot of these things. We had to, you know, roll our own for a lot of things, whether it was, you know, server-side scripting language, application servers, things like that. And so, you know, it's interesting when we think of all the things we built internally, whether it was content management systems or, you know, different publishing tools, right? It was like any one of these things that we built for ourselves because we had to at the time, you know, could have been, if somebody had been, you know, thinking hard about it, then obviously things were moving too fast to do it. You know, we could have spun out a bunch of these ideas to, you know, to become, you know, things that were very successful kind of software and infrastructure projects and companies over time, right? Whether mm-hmm. it's in the content management space or, you know, application server space, that kind of thing, right? These were all problems that we had to, you know, grow our own to solve.
So I'm curious about the at-home merger, and I don't know, you know, how privy you were to these sorts of decisions and things like that, but it's curious to me that the Excite and at-home merger happened in 98. I mean, that's still relatively early on in terms of the complete madness of you know, the bubble era.
Right.
What was the motivation behind that merger?
Yeah, so you know, at this point, you know, I was not on the board of the company, and so, you know, was sort of less privy to the negotiations that were going on. But I mean, the vision was really at the time, and again, both companies had been public for some time, right? So you know, we were both public companies when we merged, which I think the transaction was, you know, announced in sometime in 98, and then, you know, actually closed in, I guess, probably early, you know, early 99, if I'm getting my timing right. It was really the basic, you know, 30,000 foot vision was, okay, we have at home dominating broadband access, or at least the potential to do so, you know, with all the cable company relationships it had for, you know, to do broadband over cable, you know, past had a potential to reach something like 65 million subscribers, you know, in today's era with, you know, audiences in the, you know, billion plus users on Facebook, et cetera, right? 65 million doesn't sound like a lot, but that was, you know, a pretty high percentage of people who were online in the U.S. at the time. So you had really, the vision was you put Excite and At Home together and you have a broadband era AOL. Right. I mean, that was that was sort of the core of the vision, which was, you know, if you know, at the time, particularly sort of that 98, 99 time frame, you know, there was a lot of belief that, you know, one of AOL's challenges was that they had this, you know, huge subscriber base of dial-up subscribers, and they didn't, you know, if they didn't have a great story for how they were going to make that transition into the broadband era, whether it's via, you know, DSL or cable or whatever. And so, you know, the idea was put Excite and At Home together, and you could potentially kind of leapfrog them and, you know, have more broadband subscribers, you know, than they did from day one.
Right. I spoke to George about that extensively and his frustrations with eventually dealing with the cable companies and the broadband providers eventually. You leave Excite in 1999, towards the end of 99, or what's the time period?
Yeah, it was the end of 99. I December 31st, 99, or, you know, really basically through the very end of the year, but it was, you know, about a year after the merger had been, you know, announced, or closed. And, you know, it was, so, you know, I'd been at it for 6-7 years. The, you know, the company had just grown, you know, like, you know, it was up to, I think, about 3,000 people when you look at the combined company. And, you know, I had sort of come to the realization that I was a early stage guy, right? I liked working on things in the nascent phase. And, you know, by the time end of 99 rolled around, you know, the company was anything but a startup. I remember very clearly I had a moment when I sort of realized that it was going to be time for me to move on. And some of it was, I, you know, gotten involved on the advisory board of a couple companies and made a small number of, you know, angel investments. And that was sort of enticing to me. But the other piece of it was, in the year that I spent working at Oracle in 93 to 94, during that time, Oracle opened up a big new corporate cafeteria that was run by Bon Appetit Catering. And it was this, you know, kind of marketplace concept where you'd go and there was the, you know, pasta bar and the Asian food walk area and the salad area and the burger area. And, you know, you'd kind of walk around and choose your food. And it was, you know, it was good food. It was, you know, this really neat open space. And I remember, you know, I'd go to lunch there when the cafeteria opened at Oracle and, you know, see a sea of faces, right? Thousands of employees there. And, you know, only recognizing very few. And after we merged with At Home and moved into those new offices on Broadway, Excite At Home opened a large cafeteria in the marketplace model run by Bon Appetit Catering. And I walked into it, you know, like one of the first days it was open, and it brought me right back to Oracle, right? You know, it was, you know, a sea of faces who very few of whom I knew anymore. It, you know, I was like, okay, this is a big company. And, that I just remember that being a very, poignant moment, for me when it was like, okay, now I need to figure out, what I'm going to do next.
Well, and based on your CV that you spent, basically the next decade in VC stuff. You went to Mobius first, right?
Yes, correct. And, you know, wound up connected with the Mobius folks sort of randomly with, my wife was, getting her MBA at Stanford at the time. And I was at some, you know, business school event and sat next to a guy who was, named Pete Hartigan, who had been working at Mobius for a while as an associate. And he and I hit it off, and, you know, he said, hey, you should just come by the offices one day. And this is probably late 99. And, you know, I met Heidi Roizen and Brad Feld and some of the folks there, really hit it off with Brad. And then, you know, they sort of invited me to come come spend some more time there. And so starting in early 2000, I you know, started showing up at the Mobius offices. And I think I thought I would hang out there for a few months, maybe a year, figure out another company to join or start. And then, you know, the next thing I knew, I was a venture capitalist and leading leading investments and you know, again, sort of almost unintentionally backed into being a VC, but found that I really enjoyed it. And then when we had the opportunity, sort of as Mobius was transitioning, you know, to the end of its fund life for its new investments anyway, in 2005. My three partners at Foundry Group now, we were all at Mobius together, and it's Brad Feld and Jason Mendelson and Cecil Vine, and we were the guys within Mobius, and Mobius was a big fund, right? The fund I joined, Fund Six, was $1.25 billion fund, and mm-hmm. invested across stages and across sectors. But you know, the four of us were the folks within Mobius who had done the real sort of early stage stuff, and we wanted to continue doing that, and hence we decided in 2006 to launch Foundry Group, and that's kind of what led to Foundry Group and getting that going. And we launched our first fund, closed our first fund in the fall of 2007.
Well, to wrap things up, I have two possibly unfair but definitely macro questions.
Sure.
And the first one would be, because Excite started out as a technology company, as an algorithm-based search engine, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think that there could have been a place for a strong competitor to Google today?
You know, it's a question that I think is really hard to answer, and certainly one that I have asked myself many times. And I have a feeling, and I've certainly discussed it with early folks at Excite, co-founders, et cetera, right? Which is the, why weren't we Google, right? You know, which is the question you naturally ask yourself. And I have a feeling that people at InfoSeek and Lycos and AltaVista, ask that same question as well. And so, could there have been a strong competitor? Could there have been less of a lopsided market share in terms of search revenue over time? I don't know. It's hard to say, right? Google was sort of a perfect storm in many ways in terms of they built a fundamentally better search technology. There's no doubt that they built a better mousetrap, right? But the they also, again, by being sort of contrarian early on, they decided they were going to be pure play search in the early days. Of course, Google now has since grown, and it has, email and YouTube and, Google Apps, et cetera. Their most profitable core business still is search advertising. I think the interesting thing is that sort of the opportunity that Google was able to capitalize on was interesting. They were they have what I like to describe as late mover advantage, right? It was actually beneficial for them to enter the market later. I remember myself thinking when Google came along, does the world really need another search engine? And then when Kleiner and Sequoia invested in it, thinking, wow, what are they seeing here that, because I don't get it, does the world need another search engine? And, when you think about, they built a better tech, but at the same time, what they did is this advantage of being a late mover, they raised this large round, $25 million, the bubble burst, which helped them, I think, in the sense that they put their round together sort of shortly before that happened. So they were kind of well funded, able to, hire kind of the best and the brightest, who were coming out of other failed startups. they had the advantage of starting on Linux, one of the things we always regretted, and that this made things a lot cheaper for them over time. One of the things we regretted early on is we built Excite on Sun and Solaris, and constantly reevaluated over time, should we convert to Linux? But we just had too much sort of invested in that infrastructure. By starting from day one, Google with a very distributed systems and scalability oriented approach, starting on Linux and adopting Intel hardware, they were just in a much better position even just a few years later in terms of the cost of operating their service was dramatically lower than ours. And then finally, the fact that they sort of said they stayed on that search only focus for a while and then hit upon, and some folks might argue appropriated, the sort of cost per click model from Overture.
Right.
But, it was that sort of magic combination of putting that together, which is just saying, we were sort of seduced, Excite and all of the early portals by just the old school kind of display ad model, right? And there was almost, given how what our revenue ramp was, we weren't searching for, a better revenue model, right? Again, Google having had kind of the benefit of timing and staying focused on search and having lower costs, and then sort of implementing this cost per click model at just the right time when they needed to establish a revenue model. It's like you put all of those things together, and it was just became this kind of once in a generation type company and opportunity. And then of course, they executed on it magnificently, right? Which is, again, it's all of the timing is not to downplay, their much deserved success, right? Mm-hmm. It's, but I think in any sort of a juggernaut, the scale of a Google, right? You need a combination of, both, incredible talent, incredible execution, and a healthy dose of luck and timing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Then my final question is, the Foundry Group is based out of Colorado.
Yep.
And I'm thinking of Steve Case is doing his Rise of the Rest tour and things like that. And I don't want to phrase it like, why aren't you in Silicon Valley so much as, is there value to being in other places? And I'm sure you would invest in any good idea that you found, no matter where it was. But
yep.
Being outside of Silicon Valley, what are the pros and the cons, and what can you find there that might be different?
Yeah, well, when we started Foundry Group, we were focused on being a small fund, four partners. Each fund is $225 million. We have four of them active now, four active funds. And, it was... Even in Mobius, Brad Feld, my partner, it was based out here in Boulder from day one, invested nationally. And so, we started with this approach that we were going to invest across the country. And our vision was we'd probably do about a third of our investments in the Valley, a third in sort of the Colorado, Greater Rocky Mountain area, and a third everywhere else in North America, which, really concentrates itself in, New York, Boston, Seattle, Austin, kind of the other, sort of tier two non Silicon Valley markets that you would talk about. To us, the opportunity and sort of the ethos and the sort of DNA and learnings from Silicon Valley, meant that there was opportunity outside of the Valley as well, right? And so we also believed, having my partner Jason lived in the Bay Area for 10 years. I lived there for 17 years. It's one time zone away, easy to hop over there, that we would still have access to, two interesting investments and opportunities, in the Valley because of our networks. Right. And that's proven to be true. But there's also, lots of opportunities outside of Silicon Valley. And, so we have about, two thirds of our fund outside of the Valley.
Would you say there are more opportunities than there were, say, 10 or 20 years ago?
Absolutely. I think that's certainly, growing. It's a negative metaphor to use, but I think that the sort of valley ecosystem and DNA and way of approaching building businesses in the tech industry that, you know, is pioneered and you know, still happens at the greatest scale in Silicon Valley, that all of that sort of, you know, metastasized, if you will, to other geographies, right? And we were very much taking a, taking an approach of, you know, believing very strongly that we can take a lot of the lessons and then the unique attributes of different geographies and you know, really help build a community and a startup ecosystem in Boulder and Denver and beyond, and that was going on in other places as well. And I'm happy to say that that has indeed happened. It's exciting to have been a part of TechStars from the very early days, seeing that grow. That's really helped bring a lot of energy and young talent into the ecosystem here, it's only gonna continue to happen.
Well, Ryan McIntyre, thank you so much for remembering all that for us. It was fascinating conversation.
My pleasure. It's fun to take a trip down memory lane. It's now long enough ago, almost more than 20 years ago where we first started talking about Excite. So some of it is fuzzy in the lost recesses of my memory, but it's great to sort of talk through it and think about those exciting times again.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod. And my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.